cliffcentral.com. Auto Central, powered by Auto Trader on cliffcentral.com.
Right, folks, good morning. Welcome to Auto Central, brought to you by the brand that cares, autotrader.co.za, your trusted motoring marketplace. Join the conversation on our social channels, our handle at autotrader.sa, and remember to use the hashtag AutoCentral in the conversation. Full studio this morning. Some new guests in the studio, some new Auto Central friends. We have Dirk and Fani from We Buy Cars in studio, and the usual George Mini, CEO of Auto Trader. Hi, you, man.
Good on you.
Yeah, good. Good good weekend.
Yeah, no, very good weekend.
Fantastic.
Can't complain at all.
No complaints.
It's getting a bit chilly, but
it has been chilly, hey?
But no, I think Joburg winters are, you know, some of the best in the world. You've got these warm days, 18 degrees, and then freezing cold nights.
Yeah, I don't know if it beats a Durban winter, though, to be honest. Durban winter is the best. You can still, you know, it's still kind of
still
summery.
Warm. You can go surf.
Yeah, a little bit of a jersey in the morning and in the evenings, but yeah, you can still catch a couple of waves during the day. Yeah. Dirk, fine. You guys enjoying the Joburg winters?
Yes, really good weekend as well. We had a very successful trip to Loftus on Saturday.
So oh, fantastic. You guys go to the rugby, eh?
Yes.
Magic.
So luckily a win for the Box.
Yeah, very nice win for the Box. Bit of a, I know it's not a sports show, but a bit of a smaller crowd than I expected.
Yeah, quite disappointing, I think, but a win's a win, and I'm sure they'll pull better crowds in the next games.
Yeah, I think so. The Loftus faithful are a fickle bunch sometimes. There's not a lot of bulls in the side, first of all. So, and then you also know what we didn't know what we were going to get with the Box, but you know what? Hats off to them. I think they did a great job. So, I don't know if you guys saw, but Richard Hammond was in another car accident driving his, a Rimac Concept 1 electric car in a...
Yeah, what worries me about that accident is that the car set to light.
Straight afterwards,
which, you know, is that got to do with electrics, the battery? You know, is it because it's a electric car that it set to light?
So is an electric car more combustible than a petrol car?
Exactly.
Very interesting, eh?
Yeah, I mean, I think we could probably have a whole discussion around that.
But he's okay, am I
sure? Yeah, he's right. So he fractured his knee, I heard, but he got out of the car and walked away and stuff.
Yeah.
But yeah,
he's quite a lucky person, eh?
Well, this is the second big accident that he's been in.
Yeah, must have 9 lives.
I think so. There's definitely. Well, listen, I know there is an article up on autotrader.co.za that unpacks the whole incident and stuff like that. So, but I don't know. And I watched the video this morning.
Oh.
I think Picnic, huh?
I haven't seen it, but Problem in Chair.
Oh. Yeah. It definitely looks like he did something wrong. I don't know.
Look, yeah, you know, those guys push the boundaries.
No, so. You start feeling invincible, you know, driving all those fast cars, getting away with it all the time. So sooner or later, yes, something will happen. But yeah,
especially
luckily he walked away.
Exactly. Yeah, he is lucky he walked away. So anyway, guys, listen here. So we got Dirk and Fawn from We Buy Cars in studio, and it's always fantastic to have South African success stories on the show, and I think, you know, finally I'll start with you because you're on my immediate left, but where did it all start? Give us the Reader's Digest version of the, because I think everybody sees, you know, we see the billboards, we hear the ads and all that kind of stuff, but you know, I don't think people really understand that businesses don't just take off like that. It's time and effort and work. So how did it all start?
Yes, you're right. Decades of grinding, and then people call you an overnight success. But yeah, if we need to start at the beginning, We Buy Cars was officially launched in 2001. That's when I was around, I think it was 25 years old. I'm currently 42, so we're looking at a 17-year period so far. Prior to that, at school, I used to buy my first motorbike, and from a friend, and I fixed it up a bit, bought it for 400 rand, and I sold it later on for, I think it was something like 600 rand, and then the penny dropped, you know. I suddenly realized...
You can make money like this.
I can make money out of this, and, you know, being greedy, no, I'm just joking, but always wanting to improve and being better, you know, driving a better car, you know, I started wheeling and dealing a bit, always looking for bargains. Those days, you know, I was, you know, was the first to buy the junk mail, searching for bargains, looking at cars, not knowing what cars are worth. You know, nowadays we're really privileged to have all the media at our fingertips determining values on vehicles. Those days you really had to have a intuition of what's a good buy and what not, and you know, you had to make a call, and sometimes you make the wrong call. But yeah, after school then I went study teaching, still buying and selling cars. Later on I had enough money to buy two cars at a time, and yeah, that's when my brother Dirk joined me. He was then those years busy with his degree in marketing, which really helped the business, and yeah, from there we went. But I can tell you all the detail.
So I mean, buying one car at a time or two cars at a time back then. How many times did you get burnt? You know, if you had to guess, because buying one car and you get burnt, that's 100% loss.
Absolutely. I was really fortunate not to get burned early on. Our first losses was later on when we could manage that. So we were really lucky. I would say it's not just our own doing, but the fact that, you know, we've been blessed and we really went from strength to strength in those years. Yeah, nothing bad happened. A car was never stolen. The worst thing that happened is a car radio being stolen out in Sunnyside. Really? And yeah, so we were really lucky. And yeah, sometimes you would buy a car, you know, and you would make a small loss on it, and you'd learn from that mistake and never make the same mistake again. But yeah, we're in the car business, so cars do break. Sometimes, you know, you develop mechanical problems, and yeah, then you make a loss on the vehicle. But we don't ponder it. We make the loss and we move on, and that's our philosophy, is not to get married with a car and get stuck with it for 10 months. We just sell it and move on.
So, I mean, the traditional dealership that we see in the country, you obviously went down a different path to the traditional dealership. Explain to us, like, how your business is different.
Yes, I think my brother Dirk can pitch in here, because we are totally different. Early on, you know, when I was still hunting for bargains, you know, we were in a reactive sort of environment. When we reacted to other people's advertisements, and then we were in a competing market when we had to compete with other buyers in order to obtain that vehicle. So when Dirk joined the business, he started a different approach, where we advertised the service of buying cars in various ways. And by doing that, you're on the forefoot. You can you communicate with that client first and deal with that client before he's even started to advertise his vehicle. Maybe Dirk should just tell us a bit more about that.
How did you get the marketing up and running back in those days? I mean, obviously, you know, selling one, two cars at a time, there's not much profit. Now you've got to kind of guerrilla market.
And now you own pretty much every billboard in Joburg. In Joburg and all over. I mean, I've seen you guys before I saw you, if you know what I'm saying.
Yeah, I think Fani skipped a lot of detail. There's a whole intricate detail that he skipped over for brevity, but yeah, you know, there in the beginning, before he went to the UK, we were standing in the early. You're talking about the winters in the beginning of the in the cold winters. We were standing in the pitch dark in the queues to get the junk mail on a Thursday morning at 5 o'clock, because back then in the beginning it wasn't available on the internet. But later on, as time passed, Fani went to the UK for the odd 2 years, and in that time, things changed a lot. The dynamic of buying bargains, like we were bargain hunters. We were scouring every newspaper. As soon as it comes out, we're in the classifieds looking for that bargain. And back then, when you look in the classifieds or you look in junk mail, those adverts that you see there were genuine private people. Today it's not.
Yeah.
In that queue where we were standing, there were people buying parrots. There's people buying furniture. There's people for every category. There's the people who specialize in buying that. And what happened during that next 2 years? What year was that, more or less, Fani?
That was probably 2001, more or less.
Yeah. What happened then is that a lot of people lost their jobs, and they used their the money that they got out when they left their job, to try something. And one of the main things they tried, some got a welder and tried welding, others started buying cars. So very soon you were in a situation where all those cars in the junk mail were basically dealers reselling those cars. And that's while Fani was selling cars in the UK and I was here in and then I had to find a way of continuing the business while the classifieds is not working for us anymore. So what I did was I started pasting notices up everywhere I could that we come to you, we buy your car. Back then it says less than 25,000.
Okay.
That's where we started out. And basically we pasted every post office lobby in Pretoria East and in Centurion. I figured out where every, I got a map. I figured out where every single one of them is, pasted every one of them at least once a week, and later on, even there's a whole story around the ATMs. You're not allowed to paste anything on an ATM. I did that.
But that's guerrilla marketing.
That's guerrilla marketing, yes.
Wow.
Yeah, so that's essentially how it started. So, you know, you guys canvassed, you know, all the areas, and you knew where people were obviously congregating, standing in queues and stuff. And it's evolved to where it is nowadays. And that's essentially, you know, jump onto your website, webuycars.co.za, put in some details. You guys will then turn around an offer to the person based on the information that they're giving you guys. And if the consumer is happy with the kind of, I would say, pre-offer, you would then send somebody out to go and verify that the, you know, because I'm sure there's a lot of oaks who tell you, I've got this, but they're actually selling that.
Yes. Yes, that's true. Like, we were talking a lot about bargain hunting. But those days are pretty much over, you know. People are knowledgeable. They know what their cars are worth. So the whole value idea of what we offer is in a service. And we have to compete with a lot of competitors nowadays. So you can't just focus on buying bargains. You know, that's why we have such a big turnover. We currently buy and sell over 2,000 cars a month. So you can imagine we don't need to make a lot of money on each car in order to survive.
Sure.
Currently, we have representation all over the country, buyers in all the major cities. And so whoever needs our services, we can probably provide that within 24 hours. Okay. Even quicker if you're on Gauteng, if you do the online application for selling your vehicle right now, you'll have an answer within an hour, and we could still see you today and conclude the deal. It's professional, and people might ask, but what do you do with those cars? And that's a whole different thing, but I'm sure we'll talk about that later.
No, that's fine. Well, I mean, we can get into it now if you want, because I actually had a question here. I said, what is it about WeBuyCars that makes doing business with you guys so easy? And, you know, what is it about? Because, I mean, you're obviously both very approachable guys, and, you know, we were sitting, you know, off air just now having a chat, and I kind of feel like, and, you know, having spent time on your website, and I must say you've got a host of testimonials here of people just saying, you know, great service, fantastic. And I'm assuming that comes from the top down. Is that one of the philosophies of the business?
Yes, it's a culture thing. You know, we strive to always be better. We never satisfied with the status quo. We always try and find ways to improve our service, and we learn from our mistakes along the way. But yes, people are blown away with this service, because nowadays in South Africa, that's sort of non-existent in most cases. You know, one of the things on our website is a little form that you fill in, you know, where you put in your details and your vehicle details, and then you submit it and you wait for an answer, and people are stunned with the reaction time there. And I'm sort of like one of those persons when I stumble upon a website and I need a service and there's a little form. You know, sometimes you fill it in, though they never ever get back to you.
Yeah.
So yeah, that's a thing. Immediate payment. There's no red tape. It's straightforward. What you see is what you get.
Okay. So, and it's definitely a safe environment to sell a vehicle. I think we all know, being in the industry, that there's a lot of can I call them
fly-by-nights?
Yeah, fly-by-nights, and, you know, guys who are looking to make a quick buck at the expense of somebody else.
Well, I've been to Dirk and Fawn's operation in Pretoria.
Yeah,
got lost going there, but I've been there now twice, and it's you know, I can say it's really professional operation. You know, when you walk in there, you feel like this is not a fly-by-night. This is a real serious operation.
Real serious operation. Well, that's always nice to know, you know. And I was going to say, because I saw on your website you guys are actually advertising for a position, and I thought to myself, car salespeople, people in the car industry don't have the best reputation. I think we all know that. That's just a given.
I think it's around the world, eh?
It's a given in the industry.
In America,
yes.
In the UK, it's an industry thing. It's sad and it'll change, but it's one of those things.
So, I was going to ask, what do you look for in an individual?
On that point, we've over the last year, we've doubled our staff. So,
sure.
So we constantly employing new people just to keep on, you know, providing the service we do and keeping the standards up there. But one thing we don't require when we appoint people is motor vehicle industry experience, because we find when you appoint someone from the industry, they come with a lot of preconceived ideas that does not necessarily fit in to our culture and the way we do things. So we prefer people with great people skills and whatever specific to that specific position, and the rest we can train them. And that's what we do, and that's what makes us successful.
I think that it's a question that I think probably a lot of the listeners would want to understand is, if I am selling my car, what are the processes that you guys put in place to kind of evaluate that person's vehicle? Like, how is that done? It's always a question that I ask. Like, you go to a dealership, the guy looks in his, there's that little book. What's it called again?
Used to call it the Media Migrata. Nowadays it belongs to TransUnion. We certainly do use that. We subscribe to them, and they provide us with valuable information. But if you were only to use that, you would certainly burn your fingers really quickly.
Sure.
So we have a big database with past history. You know, you can imagine up to now we've sold tens of thousands of vehicles. So we have our own system that tells us more or less what we sold previous models for, and based on that we can determine a new value. And then of course the internet, you have AutoTrader and all the other competitors out there where you can compare values for specific vehicles. And just to get to the selling side, we supply around 60% of the vehicles we buy to the trade, and the first question someone would ask themselves is, but if they supply the trade, then they must really offer me a low price. And that's not the case, because we've noticed that in the trade, a car dealer's biggest problem is finding the right stock at the right moment. And we are really well connected in the trade. So we would know which dealer is looking for a specific vehicle at a specific time and is willing to pay a premium for that. And the individual selling the car might not necessarily know about this dealer, and that's where our service come in.
Okay, fantastic. Well, that's great to know. So, just another thing. Obviously, with the birth of the internet, you guys obviously started, before the internet became a...
2001,
so it wasn't such a...
The internet in South Africa started taking hold from about 2007, 2008. So you guys were in the market a good 5-6 years before.
And you've managed to do a transition, obviously, now, bulk of the business is driven by what you can and can't do online. How are you guys finding the market at the moment from a competitor? Are you seeing a lot more people enter the market from a competition point of view, like direct competitors or guys that have got similar, who have taken your model and gone, we can maybe tweak it like this or change it like that? Are you seeing much out there at the moment?
Yes, but they pop up everywhere, and I think it's a tendency in the market. People want to start doing things online. It's one thing buying cars, it's a different thing selling cars, but I think competition is good. We'd love to have a real big competitor, keeping us on our toes, but so far there hasn't been someone really, really up there, giving us carrots. But we would welcome competition. I think we can learn from each other.
Fantastic. I don't know, George, have you got any more questions?
No, I mean, I'm fascinated by your business model. It's similar things have happened around the world, and you guys have taken the bull by the horns and made it happen in South Africa. So, well done.
Yeah, fantastic. I think it's a fantastic story. And again, another successful story. Just to the listeners, it doesn't happen overnight. There's a lot of long hours and hard work and slogging. And I think what you guys are doing is fantastic. So thank you very, very much for joining us in studio today. And if you guys are looking to sell a vehicle, then We Buy Cars, they come to you and get the job done. Good prices. And you only need to go onto their website to look at the reams and reams of testimonials of happy We Buy Car customers. So Fawn and Donnie, thanks very much for coming into the studio, and it's been a pleasure having you.
Yeah, great pleasure. Thank you for inviting us.
It's only a pleasure. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Good
Tyler.
Stuff, guys. So just before you guys leave the studio, Chad is at a world record attempt, and there's a gentleman who's attempting to do the world's
longest drift.
And so Chad interviewed the gentleman this morning, and we're gonna play you that interview, and we'll join you back after this.
All right, I'm standing out here at what is a fairly brisk and chilly Gerotech at the moment, out of the skid pan section of Gerotech, where Jesse Adams from Star Motoring is actually going to tackle a Guinness World Record today. Jesse, welcome.
Hello there, how are you?
No, doing good, doing good. And you want to talk us a little more through this? We've seen that it's being listed as 8.6 Drift Record. What is the premise of the record attempt?
This is Guinness World Record for the longest vehicle drift. That's what they label it as. And drifting guys are going to know that this isn't really drifting because we've got a wet skid pan and we're going mostly in a circle. We will change direction from time to time. That is allowed by Guinness rules, but it's not really a drift per se, but this is what Guinness calls it. And yeah, this is the current record is 144.126 kilometers. So we're aiming for at least 150 today, hopefully more.
Okay, and you're running it in a circle here. How many laps is that going to entail? Because no doubt you've actually calculated all of this. And how long are those laps going to take you?
Yeah, we toiled over the lap distance and the measurements of the skid pan and what's the best way to do it. But eventually we settled on an average lap of 177 meters in a circle. That means we'd like to go 1,000 laps. That obviously means 177 Ks. And we calculate, if all goes well, that should take about 5 hours. We're hoping for less, but 5 hours is what we think is realistic.
So this is actually quite a marathon effort because, I mean, this is a full 5 hours without stopping. They don't allow breaks. You know, they don't allow you to stop and then restart again, correct?
No brakes. No, I can't stop. The rules are that my wheels can't stop spinning. So from time to time, I can lose control and, you know, spin out, but I can't let the back-powered wheel stop spinning. So, yeah, and no petrol stops, no P stops, nothing like that.
So no brakes. And I suppose that's one of the toughest aspects of this is just the endurance through it. What sort of preparations have you been doing going into this yourself as a driver?
Well, I'm not going to claim to be a super fit racing driver or anything like that, but we have done a lot of testing. We've come and done almost five practice sessions, and the longest stint we've done is about an hour, so we don't really, it's kind of going into the darkness after an hour, what might happen. But we think that if you can do an hour, you can do five.
Okay, and what sort of modifications, what vehicle are you using firstly? Okay. And what sort of modifications have needed to be carried out on the vehicle in order for it to accomplish this? Because 5 hours is quite a duration.
Yeah, the current record is with a Toyota 86. It was in Turkey, it was a German driver. And we, you know, we thought about which cars we could use for this, but Toyota 86 really is the ideal car. Smaller engine, 2 liter, naturally aspirated, should be light on fuel, rear wheel drive, small little package. You can turn the traction control completely off, which is what we need. The only modifications we've done to the car is Toyota Motorsport, Glyn Hall at Hall Speed, the same guys that do the Dakar Buckies and things like that. They put a second fuel tank in. So in the spare wheel well, there's a perfectly little round aluminium fuel tank, which holds an extra 40 liters. The standard tank has 50 liters, so we've got 90 liters to use today.
And you believe that all of this is geared and is capable of now accomplishing your, what is essentially 1,700 sort of...
The car isn't going to be a problem. We know that for a fact. The biggest challenges we have here are the surface of the skid pan. It's a painted surface, and the paint at the moment is quite flaky, so it's inconsistent. There are sections where it's a lot grippier than others, and to try to maintain a kind of a sweeping, steady drift over it can be tricky. But like I said, we've done a lot of practicing, and hopefully we can get around that and avoid the grippy sections and things like that.
Now, talk us a little bit through what actually made you go through this, and when did the idea actually come to you?
So I was overseas in end of 2015, and I was browsing my social media channels, and I came across this tweet about a guy who set a Guinness World Record for the longest drift, and I was like, oh, that's interesting, how far was it? So I started Googling and doing some research, and came across the Guinness website, and it found this guy, 144 Ks he did, and I thought, yeah, I can challenge that. I've got the resources I need in South Africa, I've got friends at Toyota, and, you know, and so I sent an application through to Guinness, and took them a while to reply, but eventually they did, and they accepted the application, and they sent a whole long list of guidelines and rules and this and that. And that's really the hardest part about setting this Guinness World Record, is all the logistics involved and organizing people. And it's a Monday morning here, and I've asked people to skip work to come here, and I really appreciate all the help from everybody.
And speaking of the help, clearly this is a bit of a group effort. Who's helped you get to this point here, to this attempt?
first step in all of this is getting a surveyor to come and measure the skid pan. He needs to measure the size of it and also that it's perfectly flat. That's one of Guinness's rules. It has to be perfectly flat. And this skid pan was built in near Pretoria in the early 80s, I believe, and it is literally perfectly flat. The surveyor couldn't believe how flat it was. And other than that, we have four witnesses, independent witnesses. This is basically Guinness's eyes, because they can't be here today. So they rely on input from four independent guys who preferably are from the drift scene and know a bit about drifting and what they're looking at. So they will take shifts and watch everything goes down and nothing funny happens and no cheating happens. And then at the end, they sign a statement and we send it off to Guinness and then they're happy. Then we also have two timekeepers who basically just time the event from the moment I start drifting to the moment I stop drifting. And if all goes well, like I said, 5 hours.
Okay, that's fantastic. Well, Jesse, we wish you the best of luck. We'll be keeping all our listeners up to date with the proceedings there, because this isn't something that we're going to be able to confirm like immediately that the record has been set. You need actually an official here to be able to confirm it instantaneously, correct?
We could have paid to have a Guinness official come from London, but it was very expensive, and we just thought it was better to do it the other way, which is to have local guys come and sign their statements and whatever. Yeah, that's okay. It.
So, and we will hear in the near future as to whether it has been
Official. We're hoping by the end of next week we'll have a confirmation. But if we pull off the 5 hours today without stopping or stalling or anything like that, we're pretty confident that it will be a record.
That's fantastic. Jesse, we want to wish you the best of luck. And guys, keep on listening. Don't forget to check out the hashtag 86 Drift Record. And we're going to be chatting a little bit more about it today, and you can catch up on our social media platforms. So that's going to be Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and the whole likes, a little more as to what's going down here today. We want to thank Jesse Adams, but Ty, back to you in the studio.
Really, really is a decent interview by Chad there, and a world record that, geez, like, imagine drifting for 5 hours, George. That's insane.
Yeah, no, I mean, geez, that's 5 hours and no pee break.
Yeah, I don't know how they're going to do that. You know, driving to Durban without a stop is hard enough. Can you imagine drifting for 5 hours?
I believe. I got this out of one of the Formula One episodes. I believe the Formula One drivers, they just go in their suit.
They just goat.
They just do it.
They call it goating.
It's called goating.
Well, runners, I know runners do that as well. But I suppose when you've got to go and you've got to go, you're not going to lose a race.
I guess you won't stop if you're like in the top two or three. If you're number 100, I'm stopping.
Yeah, exactly. Most definitely. So this is going to take us on to our next topic. And I've just been absolutely blown away by where motoring is going to go in the future. And Intel released an article the other day, and it says that in the near future, people everywhere will leave the driving to autonomous vehicles, and there's one simple fact will soon create one of the greatest economic opportunities of the 21st century. And what they've put this down to is basically that, you know, back in the day before the combustible engine was invented and people were, you know, on horse and cart, no one ever thought that they would evolve from horse and cart until the car came along. And this is essentially what, you know, we're kind of in that same situation at the moment where autonomous vehicles are on their way. And how is that going to change our consumer behavior as drivers and owners of vehicles? And there really are some interesting facts that are coming out of this this article. So like 585,000, which is a conservative estimate of the lives saved worldwide due to autonomous vehicles, which just, yeah.
I did a blog post over the weekend, and there are 1.3 million deaths per annum on roads worldwide.
1.3 million
deaths.
So we lose a million people
in the world.
In the world.
Just out of road deaths. So I think autonomous vehicles, that is probably one of the biggest benefits is, you know, the loss of lives. I'm pretty sure there's still going to be accidents and mishaps, but you know, just hopefully
probably
that,
not as drastic, because you're not going to have someone driving
at 100. Richard Hammond.
Yeah, well, I suppose he would, but then again, he was in control of the vehicle. I think when you get into an autonomous car, it's going to be driving according to its, you know, rules and regulations that are plugged into it, really.
But I also think there's dangers with autonomous driving and autonomous vehicles and electric cars that we haven't discovered yet. And, you know, so while, you know, I think it's going to be better, but I think there are things that that we still haven't discovered.
For sure. I mean, I think naturally we would, you know, discover those things as and when they're happening, just like Tesla have discovered through trial and error, I suppose, you know, R&D and, you know, making mistakes and fixing them and learning from those mistakes.
Well, I mean, if you think about the Model T, Ford and that era of car, there was no such thing as seatbelts. You know, seatbelts weren't, I mean, even I can remember when I was 9, 10, 11, 12 years old, seatbelts weren't a worn thing.
No, it wasn't a worn thing. I remember driving to school and was never like, put the seatbelt on, you know. However, nowadays you get in the car and it's just a natural reaction. It's the first thing.
Well,
you
the car shouts at you if you don't. So probably a similar thing will happen with autonomous driving cars. We'll get these antiquated autonomous driving cars when in 50 years' time we'll look back and think to ourselves, how the hell did we do that?
Did we actually drive? I mean, it's crazy. I mean, they're talking about just $234 billion is the estimated reduction in public safety cost related to traffic accidents. I mean, that's going to be. That's huge. I mean, imagine if we could, I mean, the 1 million deaths that are happening a year globally, what does that actually cost? You know,
there's medical costs, there's emergency service costs, there's the costs after the fact if you're seriously injured, you know, all of that stuff.
And then, I mean, this is the biggest for me, the amount of cash freed up by the US passengers foregoing car ownership is estimated at about $900 billion.
Wow.
So people are going to stop owning cars and really just kind of hail an autonomous vehicle to, you know, to fetch and carry you to where you want
to go, which I think is brilliant. I mean, you can kind of see it in the youngsters of today. They're not really into the status and prestige that a car used to bring in the older generation.
Definitely,
that
not.
All they seem to care about is getting from A to B.
Well, it's that instant gratification, isn't it? And I think, you know, we'll unpack this this article, I think a lot is going to change, and for me, it's really exciting. I mean, the adoption of mobility as a service is obviously central to the emergence of this global passenger economy. So, mobile connectedness, the boundaries between work and personal life, will continue to evolve and disappear. They're saying here by 2050, nearly 2/3 of the global population will obviously live in an urban environment. So, urbanization is going to get bigger, which means, you know, not everyone can own a car. We're just going to run out of space. So individual ownership is being replaced with a shared approach. So you would essentially share a ride to work in the morning with people who live in a similar area to you, and obviously reduce the costs of traveling.
Well, I mean, imagine this. Today, trains are owned by, you know, government organizations and owned by the state.
Yes.
What if motor vehicles were owned by the state?
By the state.
And it's really just something to get from A to B.
Exactly. Well, they're saying, and car makers are going to become service providers and not really sell an end product. So manufacturers will swap car sales for vehicle services and begin to compete on delivering an in-vehicle experience, which is really, really cool. I mean, if you just think about that for a little bit, you'll be able to get into the car and drive to an event or to the office and like you can in an Uber now, do an hour's worth of work. You know, let's say you're going on a date with your girlfriend. It can be really a romantic ride to the movie, you know, or go out for supper. And on your way home, you could probably watch a sitcom or something while you're traveling in the car. So I think this is really going to, you know, I'm excited about this. I think it's really, really cool that
Well, I mean, they seem to be in this piece talking about onboard beauty salons, you know, movable media, like you say, watching a sitcom, location-based advertising. So as you pass something, you know, piece of advertising pops up that says, "Did you know this exists?"
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, restaurants. You know, so you're not focusing on driving anymore. Getting into a car now becomes and experience, which is I just think that that's really, really cool. And I mean, from a social point of view, autonomous vehicles will change human behavior forever. So, you know, there's going to be passenger freedom. So riders can, you know, reduce the stress and travel time and produce more productive kind of activities or interests while they're driving in their cars. Traffic will be orchestrated and optimized. So you'll know how long it's going to take you to get from point A to point B. You know exact time that it's going to take you to get there, so you can plan accordingly. And curbside appeal, and this for me is fantastic. So there's going to be a drastic decrease in the demand for parking, which will free urban space. So you're not going to have streams of cars parked on the side of the road. So we're going to get our pavements back essentially as well, which is really, really cool. So I just think it's...
I just did a little bit of math while you were talking there.
Yes.
And I spend 13% of my waking hours driving.
Over what well, in a day?
Yeah, in a day, in a week, in a month. I just did it on an annual basis.
Yeah.
It seems to work out to about 13% of my waking time driving.
That's, you know,
it's insane.
It is insane.
And you know, if you could get into a car and you could actually be more productive with those 13, with that 13%, imagine how much more creativity people would have, and how many more things would be made in the world.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you know, what could you be doing instead of spending that time driving? It's just, I think the fact that...
I mean, I try and be productive now by using the phone and being on the phone to, you know, to the team and driving the business forward. But there's so many more things you can do.
Yeah, I mean, you know, that's, I suppose that is the thing, you know. I mean, if you had an opportunity to get into an autonomous car now and stop driving, would you... you would.
Yes.
I think so too. Yeah. I don't think driving is going to be a... I mean, it's become a pastime almost. It's like...
Well, I mean, somebody said something to me the other day that was quite interesting. Before cars, we used to ride around on horses.
Yes.
Now, just because cars exist and cars are the mode of transport and horses are not the mode of transport, people still race horses on racetracks and they still ride horses in show jumping. And so riding horses hasn't gone away.
It hasn't gone away, yeah.
It's still something that you do, but you do it for pleasure.
Correct.
So perhaps driving will become that. You know, you'll go to a track and you'll do it for the pleasure of driving. And that's why I'm, you know, a new way of thinking about motor racing is I don't know if motor racing will ever get to full electric car or full autonomous driving cars because of the joy of driving that vehicle around the track and the noise of that that engine.
Yeah, I don't think that will ever go away, you know. And people will probably, and you'll still find autonomous cars will become a thing, but then maybe on a Sunday you get into, geez, like the car with the engine and you take it for a drive so that you can hear it and smell the petrol. And
yes,
so it will become a
like horse riding is today.
Exactly. 100%. So I think, you know, it really, really is exciting. I mean, what does that do to kind of the car market in general?
It just changes. I mean, I'm pretty sure that before cars, people made money buying and selling horses. Now, the same people make money buying and selling cars.
Yeah.
I'm pretty sure that it'll just be...
And people make buying and selling money of
autonomous
vehicles.
Or things around and inside those autonomous vehicles. So I think it's just... I don't think it's a... the death of something. It's just the morphing and the changing of what we already have.
And it's a natural progression. And I think it's progressing in the right way. I think our roads are heavily congested. I just think that if people just take, you know, a step back and just
think about it differently.
I think so. I think it's something that needs to be embraced. I mean, I couldn't think of anything better than getting into a car and driving to Durban and having 5 hours to actually... Yeah, I don't know.
You get to Durban in 5?
Well, no, 6. Well, maybe with autonomous cars, you know, that will be, you'll be able to travel
a
little bit
quicker.
It will be quicker because you won't have the traffic.
Yeah.
So, you know, that's, I just think that's something that we can, you know, we could spend hours sitting here talking about. So we've got a review that we're going to get onto just now, but we're first going to go to a little music break. And when we come back, Chad, who unfortunately is not with us today, has done a pre-record. And we're reviewing the Honda CHR, which, listening to his review this morning, sounds like quite an interesting vehicle. So off to a little song, and we'll be back right now. Right, that's a little bit of Lumineers there. So into the car review. Chad dropped a line for us, and he sent us a voice recording of the review.
There, I am actually a little sick, and I just didn't want to get you guys all infected with my germs and that. But I've still got the review for you, and this week it's on the Toyota CHR, which is Toyota's latest little crossover. And I tell you what a fantastic little vehicle this is. It has become extremely popular. There's so much so that there's actually a waiting list for this little crossover. Now, we had a lovely little blue one, and I really enjoyed spending time with it. It's a great little car. I love the way that it looks. It's really aggressively styled, both on the outside and on the inside, and that's the first thing that draws you to it. Oh, just those brilliant, brilliant looks. A little bit about it, you only get it with a 1.2-litre motor, but it's not a bad motor. It's actually a very, very good four-cylinder turbo petrol motor. It makes 85 kilowatts and 185 newton metres. Now, Toyota says it's going to do 10.9 seconds 0-100. That's for the manual. And yeah, that may not sound really fast, but it really is a nippy little car. It's not supposed to be a record beater by any stretch of the imagination. Now, you get it with a 6-speed manual or with a CVT gearbox. And that means that there's actually three derivatives that you can choose from. You've got a 1.2, a 1.2 plus, and then the 1.2 plus auto, which has got that CVT gearbox. But I just want to talk a little bit about that motor. That motor is actually very, very good. It's actually very fuel efficient, as well as being quite pokey and powerful. And this is because Toyota uses a very clever system to actually change the cycles. Anybody that knows anything about the way that the internal combustion engine works will know that most cars run on what's known as an Otto cycle. And that's got your usual suck, squeeze, bang, blow, your four cycles, your four strokes. Now with the Atkinson cycle, it's actually got a reduced intake stroke, so it's not as long as the normal one. And usually this would require two crankshafts, but Toyota's been very clever, and they managed to achieve an Atkinson-style effect by leaving the intake valve open a little longer. And that just means that it pushes some of the mixture back out into the intake and means that you use less fuel, but you still get roughly the same amount of power. And it uses this under part throttle conditions and when you're just cruising along. So it's lovely. It really is lovely and fuel efficient. As I said, you get three different derivatives. 1.2 turbo, 1.2 turbo plus, and of course the plus auto. The plus has a couple of extra niceties that warrant the additional price tag. So you're going to get things like digital climate control. You're going to get alloy wheels. It comes with cruise control. It's also got rain sensing wipers, and of course you're getting fog lamps on the exterior. Other than that, the normal 1.2T is actually still just a great, great package. I was actually really, really impressed with the interior of this vehicle. I just love the way that it was styled. It was really well thought out. They're really pitching it towards the millennials and the funky, trendy sort of buyer. The buyer that's really focused on being stylish and looking good while they're out and about. And it's got all these diamond motifs in the interior, and you see it everywhere, from the clock faces to the buttons. It's on the speaker grills. It's on the door cards. It's even in the roof lining. So they've included it just about everywhere. And it really, really does look good. I like the way that it's laid out. The seats are great. It doesn't have tons of space, but it is fairly generous. Once you're in it, it's really nice and snug, and it doesn't feel too small and cosseting. It's quite a nice balance between the two. I would actually recommend going with the CVT option, because I found that the motor struggles a little bit with low-end torque. So that means that it's very, very easy to stall, and sometimes sitting in traffic, it makes it a little bit tiresome constantly working with the clutch to get it on the go. So the CVT is just going to do away with all of that. If you're not too worried about driver engagement, definitely go for the CVT, although that is the most expensive option. Pricing, while we're talking about prices here, it starts at 318,500 Rand for the 1.2T, and then it goes up to the 1.2T Plus, which is 345,000 Rand. And then if you want it with the CVT gearbox, which is the one that I would recommend, 356,000 Rand. It really is. It's a striking car. It's fun to drive. It's engaging. It's a good all-rounder vehicle. And if you want one, you're definitely going to have to get your name on the books, put down a bit of a deposit in that, and make sure you secure one at Toyota today. For more information on it, my video is up on YouTube and it is live, so you guys can go and take a look at what the vehicle looks like inside and out and hear a little more about what I think about that drive. Guys, have a great show and I'll chat to you next time. Bye-bye.
Well, thank you, Chad. Thanks for that. Very, very nice review there. George, there was lots of motorsport this weekend. So you being the our resident F1 expert.
Not really, but...
well, we our resident F1 enthusiast.
Enthusiast, yeah, that's probably the right word. Yeah, I mean, there was the F1 race on the weekend, and then there was also the MotoGP
that's correct,
on the
yes.
weekend as well. I mean, I didn't watch the MotoGP. I was very much focused on the F1. But Sebastian Vettel went into the Canadian Grand Prix ahead on points, and he left the Canadian Grand Prix ahead on points, although the gap closed a little bit between him and Lewis Hamilton.
What he's 12, he's only 12 points ahead now, if I heard correctly, I think.
Yeah, he's 12. Yeah, exactly. So Hamilton has 129 points, and Sebastian Vettel 141 points, and Valtteri Bottas is straggling at 93 points. So you know, in the qualifying on Saturday, the Ferraris and the Mercedes are neck and neck. You know, the Lewis Hamilton managed to do a lap at just over 1 minute and 11 seconds around the Canadian track, which has never been done on that track before.
Sure.
So it is the first sub 1 minute 12 lap time ever done in the history of the Canadian track. And you know, as soon as that happened, I thought to myself, there's no way that Vettel could beat this. And Vettel did a lap that was 0.03 of a second slower. Sure. So I did the maths around the speeds that they do, and how far if they were side by side and they crossed the finish line at 0.03 of a second, how much further ahead would Lewis Hamilton's car have been at 0.03 of a second?
And it must be.
It's like about 12 centimeters. Which is like this.
Yeah, exactly.
Jeez, it is literally a nose ahead at those kinds of speeds.
Well, and I don't even think the naked eye would be able to pick that up at those speeds.
Definitely
so you
not.
Would have definitely called a draw. So almost like a racehorse finish, they'd have to draw it out. And
yes, they definitely have to. So both of these drivers absolutely bringing the fight to each other. And I obviously support Sebastian Vettel, but and Ferrari ever since the Michael Schumacher days. But I've got to take my hat off to Lewis Hamilton. You know, I didn't like his attitude over the last year or two, but he's a really good driver. And one thing that that happened after that qualifying is he's now he's managed to get onto pole position 65 times in his career, and there's only one person to beat. So he matched Ayrton Senna's 65, and the only person to beat now is Michael Schumacher's with 68 pole positions. And I'm sure this year he's gonna get that.
Yeah, I mean, and he's still young, so he's still got at least a good couple of years
exactly,
in the driver's seat.
Exactly. And one thing that the Senna family did was the Senna family gave Lewis Hamilton Ayrton Senna's helmet from, I think it was 1981. I stand to be corrected.
Oh,
I think the yellow helmet from 1981, they gave it to him as a gift for matching Ayrton Senna's pole positions.
What a lovely gesture.
And you could visibly see Lewis Hamilton getting emotional.
Gave it to him, was it before or after?
It was after the qualifying, during the qualifying debrief with the top three drivers.
Sure, okay.
Which was absolutely awesome. And then the race yesterday, Max Verstappen, who, you know, probably due to his age, very, very good driver, but a little bit reckless sometimes, okay. And he shot forward from back on the grid and ended up literally in third place, I think, second place, overtook Sebastian Vettel and took off his front wing.
Because he had to do a stop to have that
to
change.
To get that wing change. So he ended up at 18th, okay. Vettel did, and Hamilton was leading the race all along, and ended up at 18th and decided to change his strategy a bit and made his way up to fifth eventually.
Jeez, like, well, that's a good fight
so
back.
Really, really good fight
so
back.
Obviously finished
I think,
in the points there, yeah.
Yeah, so I think it's going to be an interesting year.
And tell me, where do the guys go next? Do you know where the next Grand Prix is? I mean, I'm just trying to have a squeeze as well. So
I do. I think it is Azerbaijan.
Is it Azerbaijan?
Yeah.
Okay,
I think
fantastic.
It's Azerbaijan.
And that's in 2 weeks' time.
That's in 2 weeks' time.
All right, great stuff. Fantastic. Well, listen, we probably got 5 or 6 minutes left of the show, and something that I want to do touch base on just with regards to tech is dash cams. And I think the role of dash cams in helping motorists with responsible driving has obviously much been debated around the world. YouTube is littered with dash cam videos of people who have had accidents, people who have, filmed other people having accidents. And I just think from a South African point of view, what is your take on people having dash cams in their vehicles? Do you have one, first of all?
I do, okay. So my car does have a dash cam, and so does my beautiful wife Kiri's car. Has a dash cam in it as well. And for nothing else but to make sure that we have evidence of anything in any mishap in any situation.
Yes.
The dash cam has sound and video, so everything is recorded all the time, and it loops on a 16 gigabit gigabyte memory card, and then just deletes the oldest footage.
Okay,
I mean, you don't need to keep
the
old footage.
Keep the footage. Yeah. It's only if you have an incident, then that's the footage that you're going to require.
Exactly.
So it just
loops. I find that 16 gig card it fills up in about 2 weeks. So you've got lots of space.
All right. And George, tell me, do you think has having a dash cam altered the way you drive? Knowing that if something goes wrong, you literally have evidence that you could use against yourself if you were in the wrong. Do you find that having the dash cams kind of, I'm not saying that you were ever a bad driver, but has having a dash cam kind of made you go, you know what?
I don't think so. Maybe subconsciously it has, but maybe it hasn't because I was so willing to put the dash cam in the car. I don't think it has, but I do sometimes, think about the dash cam and think to myself, okay, let me just let this guy in and, that kind of thing, but not for the dash cam purposes, but
sure,
just because, you seem to subconsciously be a more responsible driver.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, there's an incident, and there's actually a video online of a guy who stops at a stop street, comes to a complete stop, does his right turn, and then gets pulled over by the cops.
Yeah.
And you can hear the conversation in the car, and the cop's like, no, listen, you didn't stop properly. And the guy's like, no, I did stop properly. Do you want to see the footage on my camera here? And the cop goes, oh, what camera? And he's like, no, my dash cam over here. And the cop was like, no, it's okay, you can go. So the guy obviously, stopped properly. I wanted to ask, do you think insurance companies would incentivize people to put dash cams in their cars to bring down kind of premiums?
I think it's, I mean, it doesn't happen in the country at the moment, but I think it's a really good idea. They've got to dictate the terms of how you use that dash cam. It's got to be on all the time. It's got to record all the footage. It's got to have a certain amount of footage, that kind of thing. But I think it's a really good idea because it doesn't happen.
No, it doesn't happen. And I mean, obviously those dash cams are activated when you switch the car on, the dash cam comes on, and when you switch the car off, there's really nothing to it.
I plugged my dash cam in. Yes, there's this cable coming down between the driver and the passenger, but there's nothing I can do about that because it's a third-party thing.
Yeah.
But other than that, I don't need to worry about it. I don't think about it. It's set to a certain angle over the bonnet. Switch the car on, it starts. Switch the car off, and it stops.
It should almost be sold as part of the package or the deal when you go and buy a new vehicle.
I don't know. I think maybe dash cams have a limited life, seeing autonomous vehicles are coming.
Well, that's what I was going to say. So autonomous vehicles will obviously, well, look, I mean, they'll be able to track absolutely everything that happens. So, yeah. You know, dash cam is going to have a limited lifespan, but there are apps that you can download on your phone and turn your phone into a dash cam.
Yeah, you can. I mean, there's lots of telemetry on the phone that some of the cheaper dash cams don't have, like what speed were you doing, what kind of force was being applied, all of the sensors on the phone get used in those apps, and they're brilliant apps. Yeah. The only trouble is if you do use your phone as a dash cam, you've got to plug it in because the app's going to constantly run and eat your battery.
You're going to charge your battery, yeah. So there's a downside to that. Well, listen, on that note, I mean, my personal opinion is that I think people should have dash cams. A question I wanted to ask is, you obviously see guys with motorbikes who have either GoPros. And I'm assuming they're using those for the exact same kind of reasons, you know?
Probably. I think GoPro is brilliant for that purpose. It doesn't have all the telemetry. Excuse me, the telemetry. But I think it's perfect for that reason. You know, GoPros are really good. You can leave them plugged in. And it's a good secondary use when you're not using it for other things.
Exactly, 100%. Well, listen, on that note, George, thanks very much for a good show.
Thanks, Tyron.
Just you and me in studio today here. And the guys from We Buy Cars, thanks very much for joining us. And tune in next week. We'll have a fresh new show with lots of interesting things to talk about. CliffCentral.com